How many of us can honestly say that we've pushed ourselves to the limits, both mentally and physically? In the case of extreme endurance athlete Daly Irvin, he decided rowing across the Atlantic Ocean was the perfect opportunity to see what he was made of.
So we're mile 750. We really haven't settled into like life on the boat. Things are like crappy. You're hungry, you're tired. And now you're like first starting to miss home. And we go through the storm, it's 2 days. And you cannot row into it because you're just getting blown back even further. So you put in this power anchor, boat is rocking like you're in a washing machine. And all you can do is sit there in your boat. So you're in this tiny little boat, you're shoulder to shoulder, leg to leg, half naked, sweating, because it's also tropical weather. And we did that for 48 hours. And if there was an eject button, oh, I would have pushed the shit out of it.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss how to challenge yourself, seek solutions, and create new markets. And now, episode 9 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we have team builder and extreme endurance athlete, Daly Irvin. Daly previously led North American operations for Student.com, a high-growth technology marketplace for student housing. With experience in launching international markets with Airbnb and Yplan, he is a seasoned leader known for building high-performing teams and leading marketplace expansion on a global scale. Daly is an expert in building go-to-market strategies throughout the U.S. and Europe, specializing in early customer discovery, market creation, sales execution, partnership development, and operations within rapid-growth business environments. He has extensive experience helping build early and mid-stage venture capital-backed companies from founding teams to 200-plus employees. He is known for his energetic and passionate approach to building teams and helping companies grow quickly in new markets with zero supply, zero demand, and zero brand recognition. He uses these experiences to advise executives and founders on innovation and rapid growth. Daly is an extreme endurance athlete competing in ultramarathon races around the world. Most recently, he set the U.S. pairs record 45 days for rowing across the Atlantic Ocean in the world's toughest rowing race. He connects his business expertise, athletics, and love for making a difference by leveraging his races to raise funds for important causes. With that being said, I would like to welcome team builder, market creator, ultra-endurance athlete, a man of many trades, Daly Irvin, to the show. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, man.
Definitely. So for those that may not be familiar with you and your journey, which we'll kind of cover here over the next hour or so, you know, kind of give them a little bit about yourself, a little bit of background.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in a tiny town in eastern Washington. I had, there was like 2,500 people in my hometown, two stoplights, lots of cows, surrounded by, you know, wheat fields and, you know, corn fields. So super, super humble beginnings, worked on a farm growing up, played three sports as you do. The town I lived in was called Ephrata, Washington, and it was, if you've ever seen Hoosiers, it's probably the closest thing to Hoosiers that you can imagine. But it was, instead of basketball, it was baseball. It was like that was like the town would come watch you play type of stuff. And then ended up getting a scholarship to go to Arizona State. Wasn't very good. And on the back of that, I started doing endurance events and started getting in the tech scene. And that kind of propelled, you know, everything after that. I was you know, launching new companies and small little startups. And and then I needed something beyond just doing that. I started doing triathlons and ultramarathons. I did my first Ironman my senior year in college. So I was training 20 hours a week, going to school for 20 hours a week, and then working 40 hours a week at a startup.
Wow.
And so that's, I mean, yeah.
So when people say I don't have enough time in the day, they're full of shit.
When I hear people, when I hear students like, oh, I'm so fucking busy. Can I cuss?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, we're allowed to cuss, so yeah, go for
it. Okay, I did see the explicit sign on that.
Yeah, we'll make sure we check the box on this one.
Yeah, exactly. So when I hear students like, oh yeah, I'm a student, I'm here for like 18 to 20 hours. I'm like, and what else? Like you have, I mean, that's what, 3-4 hours a day max?
Yeah.
Like, what else do you do?
Apparently their math is off because they're missing the other 21 somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, God, Beyonce has, you know, she's
on world tours.
Yeah, she's doing crazy stuff. And she's got kids and Jesus, lazy kids nowadays.
So yeah. Now, you grew up in pretty humble beginnings, you know, taking it kind of back as a kid, the whole nine, playing sports. Baseball, obviously, was one. Mm-hmm. What were the other two that you were into?
I did basketball and football.
Okay. Did you have a favorite at that point?
You know what? Baseball came more naturally to me. I was naturally – I didn't have to try as hard to be as good as I was. Basketball, I loved more, and I enjoyed working at it more. But I wasn't – you know, I'm 6 feet tall. I'm not a big dude. And, yeah, so baseball was easy. And that's what I kind of gravitated to, is because I was – getting more awards and recognition through that, but I enjoyed basketball more.
Got it.
There's more of a fight in it. There was more of a team aspect. Baseball, you can kind of be a lone wolf on it. You're not, like, you can only have one at bat every inning. Like,
yeah,
you just can't be a team guy, really.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed basketball more, but I wasn't that gifted.
So growing up in that area, in addition to sports, were you working on a farm? Were you doing, you know, those type of things out in an area like that?
Yeah, there's, I mean, you work in a small town, there's limited industries. You basically work at Walmart or the city.
Dairy Queen, is there a Dairy Queen? I feel like Dairy Queens are pretty prominent.
No.
Really?
We had a McDonald's and we had a McDonald's and we just got a Taco Bell like 3 years ago. I've never been yet because it wasn't there when I was there. But there was like a local pizza place and then McDonald's and that was it. And Burger King. But no, I worked on a farm. So you know, this farm had like 300 cows. And so I would like milk cows in the morning. I'd build fences and pick rocks and just like, I loved it. Like I love the manual labor. I think that's what you get when you live in a small town and you live in a farming community. You see the results of your work and you know, you get there at sunrise and you leave at sunset and like, that's your day.
Yeah.
It's not like 8 to 5. It's like you have this list of things to get done. So.
I'll tell you what's pretty impressive though is I speak to all these different people that come in, right? And they all come from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how from a small age, kind of your environment, your work ethic, kind of like your trajectory for life is determined in the settings that you're kind of raised within. So do you feel like growing up in that environment kind of was kind of the kickoff for giving you that drive and that work ethic and that determination?
There's that Stanford Steve Jobs speech when he says like your life only makes sense in reverse, and I look back at like kind of all the themes, like the central tenets, and it's basically like hard work is it. Like you might not be the most talented dude, you might not be you know, the smartest guy, but like if you just show up for work and you just work harder, like you can overcome pretty much everything in life. And that's you know, you learn that from an early age. Like you just get the work done.
Yeah.
And in my career in startups and, you know, triathlons and all, even endurance, it's the same thing. It's you might not be the fastest guy, but if you just keep going and you keep putting in the work, like you're gonna finish.
Yeah.
And but yeah, that's a super central theme like throughout the, and it started early. Yeah.
So growing up down there, being in that environment, was technology even in your thoughts at this point? Was it even an interest?
No, I had no clue. I started getting into technology my junior and senior year. You know, when you have kind of like the bullshit classes where you would like 4 good classes and 3 like lazy ones where you know you can get an A. Well, one, I was like a library TA.
Okay.
So
I don't even know what that is, but it sounds pretty nice.
Like in the library, there'd be like one guy at the end of school or end of like a class, and like they would just put the books back and just do stupid
That's
stuff.
That's a phenomenal class.
Yeah, it was a great class. And because you were an athlete, it was like you just were given these like stupid things because you can get off school and then go practice or something like that. But they subscribed to Wired Magazine, Fast Company, and Entrepreneur Magazine. So when I would get done with like your little duties that you do, I would read those magazines. So that was in like Business Week. And that's when the dot-com boom was like starting to take off, like post-Yahoo type stuff. But it was, what is it, early 2000s?
Yeah.
So this is like dig.com, and you see Kevin Rose is like an 18-year-old, you know, raised $60 million, and he has like a beanie and headphones on.
I remember
like,
that cover.
You know what I'm talking about? So I was like, oh my God, like what is this? So I started doing that. I was coding websites and learning like very basic stuff.
Okay.
And that's when... not necessarily tech side, but like entrepreneurial side. Like my parents came from, again, super humble beginnings. They've always worked for someone else. they've always been in positions where they weren't getting equity, or they, you know, it was just, you know, you show up and you get your check for that day. There was no like longevity to it. So I saw that during them. I'm like, okay, I don't want that. And this tech scene and startups and starting your own business was like, that seemed like a better path for me.
So when you went to college, you went to Arizona State?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you went there specifically for baseball at the time, right?
That was the only reason I went there, yeah.
Okay.
That and a girl, as they do. She got a scholarship to play golf, and it wasn't even the best school for me. Like, and I knew it wasn't the best school, but it was Arizona State, and I didn't even get the most money from the scholarship through that. Like, I could have went to a lot of different schools.
Yeah.
But I was like, you're following a girl, you're 18 years old, you don't really know what you're doing. And the way it was kind of sold to me during visits was like, this is the sexiest place to play baseball in the country.
I mean, isn't that still the case, though, at Arizona State to this day? It's now, still one of the top schools,
now,
right?
I don't know, but at the time, it was.
Yeah.
And I look back on it, it was probably like, it wasn't the best decision I've ever made. I just, school wasn't an option for me. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it wasn't, my parents didn't go to college, so there was no push to like excel at school. It was just, I just went to play baseball.
So there wasn't like, I'm going there for this educational aspect.
No, like I just remember like getting recruited by Notre Dame, and I was like,
that's pretty big too.
You know what I mean? I mean, they were okay. They were like, okay. They were getting like second tier players like myself. And they had like some rock stars, but that would have been a much better like education experience. But I mean, it's all hindsight 2020 now,
yeah.
But, yeah, when I look back, I'm like, God, my parents didn't really care. They had no decision or no help in that decision. They were like,
so are you kind of appreciative that they didn't step in and let you make your own decisions and be your own person? Or do you wish there was some, because most kids, especially going to college, I feel
right.
like the parents are so heavily opinionated and weigh in on that process.
Right.
And sometimes you pick a college not for yourself, but for your parents.
I think that's a from what I've heard and the people I've talked to, that's a majority of their experiences.
Yeah.
And I think now as a new dad, I think about his future, and I think about how I'm definitely not going to push him into like a certain school or something, but I'm going to lay out the options. I'm like,
yeah.
You have these options and here's the pros and cons. And I think, I guess that was the only regret, is I never even like made that list, or I never even thought about it. Like when you're 18 and you're playing baseball and you're getting recruited by good schools, you just assume that you're going to be a professional baseball player.
Yeah.
There's no like, yeah, what are, you know, what kind of other extracurriculars are there? What's, you know, what's the business program look like? That was never even a thought. I was just like, yeah, I like business and I play baseball, so I'll do that. It wasn't like, it's so funny now, and I definitely don't regret it, because it's obviously led me down this path. But for, you know, my son, I'm like, okay, we're gonna take a little bit more of an active role in like helping the decision.
Reviews, yeah.
I'm like, you could have, there's a friend of mine that I met, and his parents were like, oh yeah, well, you can go study at the University of Toronto and learn, you know, and learn French and do all this stuff. I'm like, I didn't even know that was an option.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't even in my lexicon at the time. And now I'm like, there's a million options that you can help your kid decide with. So I think it would have been helpful, but
yeah,
again, you might be in the same seat. So,
so now you go to Arizona State, you go for baseball specifically, not really focus on, you know, a major business, perhaps, like you said. How does that kind of, you know, translate? You know, do you play all 4 years? Do you stop? How does that go?
So here's the funny story. So I joined the student government in my senior year in college, and to my life, sports was like the only thing that you do. That was pretty much it. So I joined the student government thing. I was the one kid in my county to go to the state capitol and meet, you know, all the other top kids at these other counties. And when I went there was like 26 of us. I was the only kid that played sports. I was like, oh, like there's more outside of sports. And they're all talking about like, so what do you do in the summer? Like between your thing, between now and like college. I'm like, oh, I don't know. And they're like, oh, we're going to Europe. We're doing all this crazy stuff. And it just exploded my world, because I was like very myopically focused on sports. So you fast forward a little bit. The day after I graduated high school, instead of going to play summer baseball in the Midwest, I went to Europe for 10 weeks by myself. And I just like read a bunch of books. I bought a backpack and I backpacked around and lived like a bum for 10 weeks. So I didn't play sports. I came into, you know, basically fall baseball out of shape, disenchanted, and just focusing on travel and like the bigger picture of the world. So I wasn't ready to play and my mind wasn't in it. So I ended up redshirting, and then I'm like, well, I still want to play a little bit. So I played at a junior college for a year, and I was like, and half the team was on steroids and just not what I wanted to do anymore. I'm like, there's such a bigger world out here. We can actually focus on school and I can travel every year.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, yeah. So that completely changed the whole trajectory of, like, if you look at like the big forks in the road and during your life and career, yeah, like that was one of them.
So Europe was kind of like a game changer.
Yeah. Cause I mean, it just, you read all these books growing up and you don't, you know, can't put a picture or like a place to the name, and you're standing at the Roman Colosseum and you're standing in Florence seeing it, like, you know, amazing works of art, and it completely changes your paradigm of what is expected and what you're also capable of, like figuring out, you know, how to sleep on a, you know, in the train station in Budapest when you're 19. Like it completely changes your ability to do things.
Did you decide to go by yourself because you wanted to truly do it on your own? Was it because you had nobody else that was down to do it? You know, what made you go by yourself?
Yeah, I mean, the choice to go by myself was, one, I didn't want to offer it to anyone else because I know I'd be exposed to things that would be a little bit more tough. If you have a buddy, it's, you have this like safety valve that you can kind of like pull. Yeah. So I wanted to be like, I just want to go meet people and expose myself to everything. And I don't want to rely on someone to like, oh, well, I want to go to Madrid. I'm like, well, I'm going to go to Barcelona and I want to stay in Barcelona.
Yeah.
I didn't want that decision tree to be dictated by someone else at that time.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was the greatest. I learned more in 10 weeks than I did in 4 years of school, for sure.
That's amazing. You know, I talk on education with a lot of people on this show,
mm-hmm,
and I talk about college and how important do we really think it is, right? If you're going to be a politician, a lawyer, things like that, you have to go get certain, sure, degrees. But for a lot of people, you know, I'm one of those that I went to college, I played sports, but yep, education was not my focus.
No, absolutely.
And I learned through real life experiences, right, not so much from a book. So it sounds like, you know, on your end, college was not like a game changer for you for exactly what you wanted. It was more kind of showing you what you didn't want in a lot of ways, especially from the sense of like traveling by yourself. I look at that as like, once again, kind of scaling back to your childhood where you were doing everything yourself. You were responsible for doing the farming, doing this. You were in charge of you.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of that mentality transitioned over and still is transitioning over in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that school is, my wife talks about it as like your next best alternative. And for me, I didn't have another alternative. It was like, it was just school. So like, it was 4 years of a waste for me, but I didn't have another alternative that was equally exciting. I didn't have, and my wife didn't go to school. She didn't go to university because she had an amazing job, like right when she was 18, 19. So for me, it's, I was more interesting because of the Europe trip going into school. So it was great for like meeting new friends and meeting new girls and doing all that stuff. But it wasn't, that in England, it's a very common thing to take your gap year. So after high school, you take a gap year and you travel around the world by yourself, figure out kind of what you want to do, and then you go to school.
Yeah.
And I wish it was a little bit more extended for that. But going into school, it was a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
And as a business person looking at Arizona State, fantastic business. They had like 80,000 students there. And a lot of my classes were taught by TAs, teacher's assistants.
Yeah.
There was no like head of some doctor that's writing these amazing thesis. They were having like 19-year-old kids teach classes. So you'd be there with 60, you know, 60 other people. You'd be like, I'm spending 20 grand a,
yeah,
year for this. Like, what a waste.
And you could put 20 grand into
anything,
investing
a
into
business,
something else.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, you can travel the world on 20 grand.
Yeah. I mean, I hate
for
it.
For a year.
Because I don't want to knock, like, I feel like every time I talk about it, I knock education. And I think, look, if people
for
support
a lot of people,
it and you
great.
Can learn things,
yeah,
I think it's all for,
yeah,
them. For me, it was not my thing.
Mm.
And I think, you know, at the end of the day, but if you're not going to go, it's like you said, if it's going to be your backup, that's different. You know, you have to have a plan still. You can't,
yeah,
just be lazy.
Right.
And I feel like as long as you kind of want to get out there, be hungry, I'd rather blow 20K a year figuring shit out versus 20K to really go to meal plan and party.
That's right. And I think for me, because I didn't have, what it did was it exposed me to a lot of different things. Like I entered like a business plan competition my senior year. And just a stupid like one-page business plan thing, and I won, and I ended up getting paired with a serial entrepreneur that started a bunch of tech companies and manufacturing companies. So that got me into my first internship with a guy who knew his shit and was a multimillionaire. So to see someone like build a business from the ground up, if it wasn't for going to Arizona State and fucking around, I would have never had that experience.
Yeah.
And the same thing, because the weather is good all year round. They have some of the best triathletes in the world. They go there and live and train. So if it wasn't for that, I would have never met that triathlon community that would have, you know, now I'm doing races, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later. So it was good for me because you just kind of like soak up where your environment is. So it was a good environment for one, startups, and then two, the triathlon side. But the education experience, I don't think I've used anything from that 4 years that has benefited me in terms of like a lesson or a learning from those classes. Probably not.
So when you came back from Europe and you go back to school, you go into baseball, like you said, you're out of shape, disenchanted. You know, what is kind of your head at this point? Are you figuring out what you want to do with your life? Are you just kind of taking it easy? What's kind of your thought process?
So initially, I mean, because you're like, as a competitive guy, you go in there and you want to like get back in it. So like, I hit it really hard. I started like lifting weights, like super heavy, doing every little thing to see some playing time. And I got to the point where, again, like half the team was on steroids. Half the guys were just meatheads and like still had this vision of like when you're 12 and you want to play Major League Baseball. I just saw that none of us are probably good enough to get there. But people like even like juniors and seniors still had this mindset that like, I'm gonna be the next, you know, whoever, Ken Griffey Jr., whatever. That's a little age difference.
Ken Griffey was amazing.
He was a G. So, but I just learned really early on. I'm like, do I want to spend all of my time playing baseball? I really don't enjoy it anymore. It was taking up all your time. You have gym session before school. You have a 5 hours of practice and then gym session after that. So that's your professional job. And I was broke as shit. So like I needed to make money and you can't have a job and play sports.
Really tough.
So, and Uber wasn't around. So I couldn't drive Uber when you're in college. Kids nowadays have it easy. They could drive Uber and go to school. That's a full-time job. Anyway, I digress. But, but yeah, it was like, and you have no skills at that point. So your jobs are like working at a bar or a restaurant. So to do that and then like wake up early and go to the gym, and it just, I was like, there's so much more to life than trying this out. I just realized, I'm like, we need to get into business and make money because I'm not going to be a professional baseball player. It's just not going to work.
So when you end up meeting this guy, winning this business competition, is this kind of your first taste of true business?
This is why it was amazing. And it was funny because I kind of blew it. Like I didn't do that well in this job. And looking back on it now, it was such a blessing in disguise. So he just bought this manufacturing business. It was manufacturing animal pharmaceuticals. Someone brought him the deal. He bought it. And he's like, okay, I'm gonna turn this thing around. So basically he said, you're gonna be here for, I think it started in January. You're gonna be here for 6 months and save me as much money as possible and I'll give you a percentage of it. Plus I'll pay you, I think at that time it was like $18 an hour, which is like,
that is a lot of money.
For a senior,
yeah.
And like my rent was like $400 or something. So I was like, okay, this is great. So basically he's like, you have any resources you need. This is an old business that started in the 1970s. It's 1970s equipment out there. The people have been here since 1970s. So just figure it out. And whatever you save me, I'll give you a percentage of what we save. So there was like little things like the manufacturing line. So basically there'd be this big thing and it would spit out these pellets that like rats would eat, and it would like it was basically rat poison. But the line, it would fill up these buckets that are like probably like 50-pound buckets, but it was like 12 inches off the ground. So I was like, okay, the first thing you need to do is like, you need to figure out like what you're actually producing, like figure out what the metrics look like for in the business. So like I had like a mobile phone, like a first PDA thing. And I found this app online that you could, not even an app, but it was like a software system that you download onto your phone. So it was like starting and stopping like these like stopwatches, like there's like multiple stopwatches. You figure out exactly what the machines are producing, how often it takes to produce like one bucket, one pallet. And like, so if you do this over a course of a week, you can see how productivity looks for the entire team. So I have like multiple of these going on in this giant manufacturing facility. So basically what I noticed, the guys worked 4 10-hour days. So what I saw was by the Thursday, they were dragging ass. They were doing like half the work that they were doing on Monday when they were fresh. So I'm like, what's going on? So because the manufacturing lines were at like 12 inches above the ground, they had to pick them up and then put them on a pallet. So I'm like, okay, these guys are just physically getting tired.
Yeah.
So by raising it up to 24 inches, all they have to do is slide it onto the pallet. So just by doing that, like, it leveled out productivity Monday through Friday or Monday through Thursday. So like, if you adjust for productivity and all this other stuff, it was like a huge, massive savings. The other thing was, all their buckets came like unlabeled, for instance. So one day a week, they'd spend the entire, like, guys that are making $20 an hour, they would like put stickers onto these labels that you'd see at like Home Depot and stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why don't we take it to the manufacturing firm and have them do it? And then you guys can like,
it.
Yeah, like super simple stuff, but like nothing has changed. So like little things like that, I ended up saving like $500,000. And here's the big mistake. And this is why I ended up getting into sales right after college. I didn't have a final meeting with him to show him everything I did. So I never got to like present, here's all of the savings. So I like finished my internship and he was traveling or something. And I just kind of shot him an email and be like, here's what I did. And like, I didn't get to sell it. I didn't get to sell him like the benefit and how his impact's going to, like, the impact is going to last for a really long time. And he's like, yeah, I think you did just an okay job. And I ended up getting like $3,000 or something like that as a bonus. And it should have been like 30.
And you already, just off those little changes, were saving about $500,000.
Like a year. And then all these, I'm like, here's the, and I didn't, and that was the thing about not being able to like tell your full story and like about storytelling about, here's all the things we discovered. Here's the potential of like where this could go. And I didn't have that time with him. I didn't have that face-to-face interaction before he made a decision. So he could have been having a bad day. He saw my email and said, yeah, okay job, but not great.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got like $3,000. I sent him like this email now that I'd be embarrassed to read probably.
Yeah.
And he's like, let me give you a little lesson here, kid. Like, you didn't do a good enough job. You could have done much better. I could have had, for your, what I paid you, I could have paid two more other people and I would have saved $1,000,000. And that was a lesson I took with me all the time. I'm like, if you can't show someone or tell someone face to face what you're doing, what you could do and where the future lies, they're only going to believe your email. And then it's up to them to like,
yeah. I mean, it's diagnose. A good point. They're gonna break it down in the way that they read it, and we all translate emails differently. I may read something and say it sounds like they're being aggressive, but you just may be an excited person, uses a lot of exclamation points.
Yeah.
So for, you always hear people, they're like, I'm trying to connect, or you know, I want to meet this person, or I want to be mentored, and a lot of people send these emails that are just half-ass. Do you recommend people pick up the phone? Do you recommend they email till they can get a meeting with them, till they can really convey what they're trying to get across? Like, what would be your best piece of advice off of that?
If someone wants to meet like a random person, or someone wants,
yeah, like
some,
especially
time
in this day and age, because people always say, I wish I could connect with this person, or you know, I want to set up a meeting, or how do I get in front of them? Like, people always want to meet people or be, yeah, I want a mentor,
yeah,
but they'll send like a text message, they'll shoot a LinkedIn, they'll send an email that just says, hey, can I meet with you? What, like, if you were now at this point, yeah, in the game where technology is, how would you get in front of somebody that you wanted to meet or make an impact on?
Sure. Anyone now is accessible. And if you just look a little bit above average and you ask for like one specific piece of advice from someone that you know has it, and you show like that you've gone a little bit more than the average person. Like, if someone came up to you and be like, hey, I'm starting a PR firm in New York. I've seen what you guys are up to. I really love this project and I love this project. I would love your feedback on this. You would answer that email 9 times out of 10 and give them an hour phone call, right? Absolutely.
Yeah. If it was positioned that way.
100%. If it was positioned that way, or if it went through like a trusted friend.
And I'll tell you, a trusted friend for sure. But the way you prefaced it, I agree. If somebody compliments you first or acknowledges what you're doing, I'm way more inclined to want to help them out. But when people ask me for things, and I think most successful people probably see this, is you go after these entrepreneurs, these millionaires, these, you know, CEOs, and you say, what can you do? Can you do this for me? They got it backwards. They should be saying, yeah, they should be saying to them, here's how I think I can help you. And then in reverse, then make your ask.
Or have like a very specific, like, people, I think people like us love to give advice if requested.
Yeah.
Like, if you have something, you know, in your kind of, if your lane is super important to someone, like you're willing to share all of your knowledge.
100%.
If someone is good, like, you get a lot of bullshit emails where like, tell me about your 4 favorite books. I'm like, all right, fuck off. That's in some podcast or some email link
scripted.
Or something.
Yeah.
But if someone is like, oh, I saw what you did at Stu.com. I'm in this very similar space. and I'm looking for this, like if they want one specific nugget or something, like anytime someone gives you 15 minutes, that means an hour. And if you could just get like 10 minutes or 15 minutes with anyone, like they'll give you enough if you're good enough.
Yeah.
And you show like the hustle to make it happen. So if you want to approach someone like Richard Branson or Reid Hoffman, you better have a shit hot email that you're offering something that no one else has offered them, because they're billionaires. They don't have the time to deal with you. But if you offer something very, very specific that's so targeted, and you know that on a panel they specifically asked or were like questioning something, like you just need to do your research.
Yeah.
And when I need to reach out to someone on LinkedIn for like a business deal, like I'll do another 30 minutes of research just to put in a perfect, you know, response to them. And I get a huge like response.
Yeah.
Like people who, when I'm jumping into new industries, I take a very humble approach and be like, hey, I'm new, brand new to this industry. This is what I'm focused on. I have this specific question about this deal that you did here. I would love 5 minutes of your time. I'll go anywhere. And like anyone, you know, most entrepreneurs or executives will be like, okay, I'll give this guy 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And everyone has fucking 5 minutes. So
100%. All right. Very cool. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think a lot of people, when they say it's too hard, I can't get in touch, in this day and age, there's so many ways to, it's not asking, it's the way in which you ask is kind of the takeaway.
Yeah. Ask for advice, and it needs to be a very specific question that could be answerable, not like
not the generic bullshit.
Not yeah. How do you get a mentor? Like something stupid. Like I see that all the time. Like I'm looking. Yeah. How do I? I'm like whatever. Just like have a very specific case, a very specific problem that you want someone to answer for you.
Yeah.
And show that you're willing to do anything to get it.
So you get this email back, you realize that you've made him a lot more money by the savings and the time and problem solving that you implemented.
Yep.
Yet he kind of taught you this big life lesson. And this is another takeaway in life, I assume, that you look at. So now after you get this email, are you deflated? Like, are you discouraged, or does this motivate you?
You know, I was a little bummed out. So I was, that was like right after I graduated college. I was like going into like graduation, and I was hoping like if I did a good enough job, like I would think that he wanted to hire me full time as well. That was kind of the hope. So the money thing was like tertiary. And I was like more of like, if I was that good, he would have hired me. So I was like, okay, I have a really honest conversation with myself. So one, I didn't sell what I did very well. And two, clearly I'm not good enough for him to think that like, I can't let this guy go. And you've hired people before. And you're like, if someone is awesome, you'll do anything to keep them.
100%.
So if someone's like, hey, you know, my internship's ending, and you're like, okay, cool, but like if you don't feel that compulsion as a business owner to like hire this guy because he's so amazing, then I'm like, okay, I just wasn't good enough. So I'm like, one, I probably didn't bring my A game all the time. Two, I didn't sell what I did very well. And but I was bummed because I was going to Brazil for Ironman Brazil, and I needed money.
So is this your first?
That's my first Ironman. Okay. Yeah. So I was like, God, I was hoping for like 15, 20 grand, something big. And I was like, you know, calculating it out. I'm like, okay, I'm either staying in this hotel based on how much I make. I ended up having to put up like the whole thing on my credit card. And I'm like, what a way to start your life is like in credit card debt, student debt, and in the worst financial situation in the world.
So you don't get the job, you don't get the check you're hoping for. And now you're going to Brazil.
Yeah.
How did you come upon picking Brazil as your first Ironman?
I wanted to do something before I graduated college. I wanted to do an Ironman as I was graduating, and it ended up happening like 2 weeks after I graduated college. But I wanted something that was like, that was my capstone, like when I graduated. And I always just assume I would graduate college anyway. It wasn't like a huge accomplishment for me, meaning that like I didn't try that hard. It wasn't a tough school. My Ironman was like a bigger accomplishment for me because it showed that I can like not only do all these different things, but also, you know, provide and all that other stuff. So
how long did you train for this upcoming race?
About a year.
Okay.
So my entire senior year was
straight training.
And I was doing like half marathons and stuff before that. And someone dared me when we were like, most interesting things that I've done in my life is typically you were like kind of drunk.
Yeah.
And someone's like, oh, I bet you can't do that. And then kind of the funny story how I got into triathlon was I couldn't afford a bike, but then my roommate drunkenly ran into my car. So I got an insurance check, and that's how I bought my first triathlon bike.
Oh, that's amazing.
And So I'm like, okay, now I can actually do it. And so I signed up for an Olympic triathlon before I even had a bike, before I even knew how to swim.
And before you ever did a triathlon.
And before I ever did a triathlon. And that's another kind of like theme is like, I always sign up before I'm ready because you can always figure it out.
So that's kind of your motto.
Absolutely. With everything. When I did an Ironman, that's the first marathon I ever ran was in an Ironman.
Yeah.
Before doing an ultra, like I've never ran more than a marathon. And then you can go like to 100 miles. And then as we get into like the more endurance stuff, it's, sign up before you're ready. Then one, it puts a deadline and you have to figure it out.
So how'd you do in the Brazil race?
I think I did okay. I was probably in like the middle of the pack. I finished in a little over 12 hours for my first one.
Amazing.
Yeah, I was good enough.
But was that kind of your first taste of the endurance athlete world?
That was the first taste into like the big races, like when you're out there for a day or half a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So you finish the race, you come back. What's kind of the next step?
So I need to get a job.
Yeah. You got to pay because all your money's gone now.
All my money's gone. I'm in debt. Yeah. I'm in debt. I don't have any job prospects at all.
Okay.
My girlfriend was living in San Diego at the time. So I'm like, okay, I'll move over there. You know, I like the beach. Great. And that was 2008. That was the financial crisis. So that was no one was hiring. And if you were hiring, I remember going to interviews for just like sales jobs when you're 18. Like there's nothing else you can really do other than sales.
Yeah.
Or you're 22 when you graduate. But so it was... no jobs. And then I was going to interviews and there'd be 150 people in the room and they're choosing like one person and you're by far the youngest person and your resume looks like shit. You're like,
it's like life accomplishments up to this point.
Yeah. Like nothing. And like, and I thought I was going to like rely on the Ironman Brazil thing, which got me into the door for other things. But I like, that was like the biggest accomplishment of my life. The rest was like working at a pizza place and like not screwing up. So like, and then you're going against like industry veterans for this one sales job. Like not ideal.
So you get to San Diego and you just take kind of jobs as they come and you can get
them. I was like doing like little consulting gigs and then I got a job at probably when I look back at it, probably one of the best first jobs for a college kid, and that's in like 100% commission sales. And 100% commission sales mean that if you don't sell, you don't eat. So if you're not getting a contract signed and they're not paying, you don't get any money. And
that's real.
It's real. So, and especially when you're in, I was selling software to medical doctors and hospitals and big hospital practices. So you're a 22-year-old, fresh out of school, just learning how to sell. They gave you like the binder to learn. And that's really all you have. And their business model is to churn through a bunch of reps. A couple reps will sell a couple things, and then that just gets rolled up to the manager. That's really their model. So they're hiring. It's like a farm.
Yeah.
It's like a boiler room. And so if you want to be good, like you really have to take your career into your own hands. So I was, you know, Tony Robbins books. Zig Ziglar is a big sales guy for some people who know that one. But Jim Rohn, just like... taking in all the sales knowledge that I could. I was like reading books, going to conferences, and trying to hone my skills as a salesman and then a disciplined person in general. Because if you get 10 doors slammed in your face and it's only noon and you know that you have to come do that for another, you know, 4 or 5 hours before you go home, like it wears on you.
It's a little debilitating.
It's a little bit debilitating and a lot of people give up. So, you know, I lasted a year before a doctor hired me for another business. And to last a year was like, you know, going to the Olympics, basically. Like I won a bunch of awards, like Rookie of the Year. And I was the highest paid sales guy in San Diego. Like I ended up doing really well. I was making, at the end of that, I was making six figures. Like I was selling really well. But for the first 4 months, I was like ramen.
You know what, though? It's interesting. Everything you've kind of done up to this point has been contingent on the success of yourself,
right?
Not on teams and not on others doing it for you. So you've always kind of had this weight or this what people would see as pressure. You don't. You kind of look at it as like a challenge in a lot of ways.
I mean, that's exactly right. So, like, I'll always take a bet on me. Like, I can't always vouch for my team or anything else, but like, I'll always bet on myself. Like, if it's like I know I can learn it, or I know I can figure it out. And yeah, I think that's such an interesting that you've teased out there, because I think now it's and so on the like moving a little bit forward, when I was interviewing at Airbnb, I ended up getting the job in San Francisco, but my girlfriend at the time was moving to London. So I'm like, great job at Airbnb, but I'm actually going to London. And they're like, well, we're actually launching our UK office and launching around Europe as well. So why don't you interview with the MD for London? So I started interviewing. He's like, yeah, great skill set. But we're just not looking for someone of like of what you're doing. And I'm like, let me stop you there. I will work for free. And if after 3 months you think I'm shit, then you can fire me and we'll part ways as friends, absolutely. But after 3 months, if you think I'm good, then we can talk about a position. But I was so sold on Airbnb being the next big thing that I just wanted to get in. And I was betting on myself, again, I'll work for free until like you think I'm good enough.
Yeah.
And again, that was kind of what I learned when I was doing the pharmaceutical stuff, because it was like, if you're not good, if you can't bet on yourself, and you're just not gonna make it. So I was like, I'm willing to put everything on the line to make it happen.
See, I love hearing stories like that where people are like, I'll work for free, I'll do what it takes. I mean, my first chance into the music industry, I mean, I remember being in Orlando and going to a guy's house and meeting with him for like literally 9 months, till it wasn't until I took his trash out one night that he said, all right, I'll give you a shot.
That's right.
And the thing is that I feel like too many people give up too early, or they're not willing to really say, I'm going to sacrifice, but they're not really sacrificing. No. So Airbnb, I mean, and you're seeing something in this company. I mean, they're a little company now. Not too big at this point.
Yeah, they're like fourth or fifth largest private company.
A few billion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the most successful startups of all time. Yeah.
So you gained the experience from the doctor, you know, medical sales and software. So now you're kind of combining two worlds. You're combining the sales world and the tech world in mm-hmm. the early infancy stages.
Right.
When's kind of your first foray into the tech space?
So with Airbnb, it was the first pure tech company that wasn't a legacy business. And okay. What I mean by that, there was another job in there where I was selling software, but it was like a 30-year-old company. It didn't behave like a startup, or, you know, it wasn't scrappy. It was like, we just want, like, the goal is to sell more than last year, mm-hmm. but the goal wasn't to take over the world.
Got it.
And Airbnb was like, we want to get rid of hotels, and we want people to travel like locals.
What year was this that you...
This was 2011.
2000. So Airbnb at this point is literally in its infancy stage? Or is it just going on?
So they're 3 years old when I joined.
Okay.
So this was 2011, 2010, 3 years old, about 60, 70 employees. Just was starting kind of take off in the US and had enough mass to kind of start attracting real talent. And the reason why Airbnb was so interesting to me, because when I was traveling Europe, I was couch surfing. And when I came back to college, I was like, why is no one monetizing couch surfing? I'm like, I would gladly pay 10 to 20 euros to sleep on someone's couch that I knew that was good. And that was like what Airbnb ended up doing. So I just identified with that problem. So that one was, you know, a huge VC backed company. And I think what the difference between like a startup and a legacy business or like a, you know, a big company is that you don't know what you don't know, but you have enough money to try to figure it out. And you have kind of a collection of some of the smartest minds in the room trying to solve a problem that not many people know that they have yet. And so launching in London, for instance, there was in the UK in general, I think there was 400 listings. So these are people who have heard about it randomly, 400 only. So it was in its infancy. So we had, and I think this is amazing about startups, is that you have to figure everything out. They're like, how do you get more hosts, for instance? I'm like, I don't know. Like, you can't market to these people. You can't just like put out an ad and be like, list your space so a stranger can come like have sex in your house. Like, that's just not a punchline you want in the Evening Standard.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we had to do, you're just scrappy and you just figure it out. And I think that's why my background lends itself to startups, is that there is no definitive answer. And, you know, if you have the will and the why, you can figure it out. And then you can kind of systematize it and scale a business. But all the stuff we did in Airbnb to launch it overseas was not, they don't do that now. But you had to do that to get your first, you know, 1,000 customers or kind of get that critical mass before it can kind of take off. And then you can... And then it becomes the science for like sales and marketing and stuff. But
got it. So when you interviewed in London and said, I'll work for free for 3 months, you ended up getting the job, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, said, well, like,
they
how can
at
I,
you crazy? Were they like,
well, yeah, because I was the only American in the room as well. So they're like, who is this fucking American? Like, come in here, think he's like, whatever. Yeah. So I got the job and, you know,
what was your role?
My initial role was business development.
Okay.
And it was basically to acquire two sides of the marketplace. You have travelers and you have hosts. And the hosts are the most valuable, the people with actually the homes. So it's like, how do you increase the number of homes? So I'm like, okay. They have an equivalent to Craigslist over there called Gumtree. So I just started calling B&Bs that were listing their places on Gumtree. So imagine some like British lady that's 70 years old getting a call from me. And this is like George Bush, bunch of crazy Iraq wars, kind of crazy right now. And so they're like, who is this George Bush asshole American company coming over to steal our business? Like, they didn't know that we were like trying to partner. So I'd be like, nah, you know, hey ma'am, you know, I'm actually Canadian. And, but yeah, so I was making 60 to 90 calls a day. We ended up getting a little bit more scrappy and even having like dinners with the host and inviting people from the neighborhood to show that, you know, Janice and Jim were meeting the most interesting people from all over the world, staying with them, and they're paying off their mortgage. And so we started doing those every single week, every single day. And then that's kind of how the initial scale launched. And when we finished that year, I think we had 20,000 hosts throughout the U.S.
So you went from
throughout the U.K.
So you went from 400 to 20,000 in one year.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was... And that was the most magical year for Airbnb. I think if you read it in the press, that was when there was a ton of other competitors that raised anywhere from 50 to 100 million all over the world that we were fending off. So we had a ton of competition. We were launching new markets. We went from 70 employees to 500 in one year. So that was a very magical time. And by the end of the year, we were the clear winner. That's when you see like the hockey stick growth.
Yeah.
That was the year that probably defined a lot of what, that was the year, year four for them. So the first 3 years, they were kind of like toiling away. They launched three or four times, and that was the year that like it really started to move.
Gotcha.
So it was, I mean, it was unbelievably lucky. And yeah, if it didn't work for free, it's funny, a lot of people, young kids that are coming out of college now, like, how do I get a job at Uber? How do I get a job at Twitter? How do I get a job at Facebook and all this? I'm like,
intern.
Yeah. Not only intern, but like do things that don't, like people don't want to do. Like if you're coming from a decent school, like you look just like everyone else. But if you show up and you're like, I'll work for free, like what hiring manager is going to say no to that?
Yeah, they got nothing to lose.
And then that's another thing when people are like, oh, I don't know what to do with my life. I'm like, where would you go work for free? Like, where would you, in any industry or anything?
Great question to ask, yeah.
Like, what would you do for free? Like, if money wasn't an option? Like, I had a little bit saved up. If I didn't have anything saved up, then I couldn't have physically and mentally done that. But
so now, how long did you stay with Airbnb? How many times did your role change within the company?
Yeah, it changed three times. Okay. So I initially started in business development. Basically, we were acquiring kind of marquee properties throughout the UK so that we can market them back and then acquire other like properties. So on my team, if you see a castle in the UK or Europe, it's a 90% chance that was my team who brought it on. So we had like the William Wallace Castle in Edinburgh. We had like the Tower of London for a night. Like we were doing all this crazy stuff. So on the back of that, we acquired our largest competitor in England. So I was the person that led through that kind of transition and basically brought everyone on their platform over to ours, which was like a hand-holding experience.
Yeah.
Because again, from their perspective, George Bush's company is buying this little cottage company in the UK. So it wasn't smooth. And then after that, they brought me back to San Francisco to train the sales staff. They never had a national sales kind of manager to run. Because at that point, they were just riding high on PR and all the other stuff. It wasn't tactical. So like in Miami or Washington, D.C. or New York, they were short on places to stay. So we had to go into like very hard to get markets and acquire new supply and a supply that you couldn't access with like marketing dollars. So I was there for a year. In the middle of that, again, that company was taking off. Like it was already a rocket ship and I felt really, really cool about it. But I always wanted to start my own thing. And two very smart co-founders with really great investors approached me at an Airbnb launch party in London. And they're like, hey, we got this other company. We want to be, it was right when like mobile transactions were kind of taking off. The company was called Yplan. We ended up raising about $38 million for the business. And The concept was we want to curate a list of the coolest things going on in a city, and then you could buy a ticket with two taps and then rock up to a venue. So it could be like music or comedy, or we did like sponsored events with Burberry and Tanqueray. It's like drink with like Jake Bugg and like some of the Rolling Stones, for instance. That was like the stuff that we would do. So the concept was like, no matter where you go in the world, you have the pulse of a city. You can like go out like a local would.
Got it.
And there wasn't anyone else in the mobile space, and that's why we got a, so it's like us, Hotel Night, and Uber were the only ones that raising money at scale for that business. So they're like, you can be a founding team member, and so like the first basically outside employer than the founders to start the business. So I'm like, okay, Airbnb is great, equity kind of locked in, and actually I wanted to be like from Genesis all the way through, as opposed to like just the land and expand guy.
Yeah. And now what was your role with Y-Plan?
So I was director of business development for that one. So after 9 months, we ended up raising another like $14 million.
Wow.
We conquered London. We were everywhere. We were the hottest app. We were doing about $1 million a month in revenue. And we were about to raise another big round. So after 9 months, the investor's like, well, it's great that you guys are awesome in London, but now you need to expand. And because the investor's money was coming from the US, they're like, if you can't launch the US, you guys are nothing. So flew out to New York, ended up getting an apartment in New York and launching New York and running that team. So I was the GM for North America for those guys. So we launched Las Vegas, San Francisco, and I was still living in London at the time too. So my plane rides were basically New York, San Francisco, Las Vegas, New York and London, Edinburgh, and back. So I was like in the middle of launching all these, hiring teams, and just going crazy. So really exciting time. The business didn't end up taking off in the US. It was interesting because London, for instance, it was about 3 to 4 years behind the tech scene in the US. So London, you're shit hot, and then you come over to the US. When you came to New York, like every single app had already been built for each independent vertical. So we were kind of like the Time Out magazine, digitized and like actionable. In New York, there was already like 4 or 5 music apps that are like the best access to music. They had 4 or 5 bar apps that were the best access to the coolest bars. So every vertical was already taken up, and we were just good at all of them.
Yeah.
We weren't like badass at really any of them.
If the investor never asked you guys to come over to the US, would you just have stayed European-based?
We might have. Yeah, we probably would have.
Because it sounds like because New York and the States had so many verticals already in place, that probably wasn't even a thought in the mind, are we going to be competitive in the U.S.?
It just wasn't purely thought out. And I think about it now, I'm like, God, what a rookie move to not like take a couple trips out there and really see what the market felt like. We probably would have been in a more defensible position if we stayed in Europe and launch in like some bigger cities over there. But again, the reason why we didn't, because it wasn't English speaking. And when you start launching in Europe, which I saw with Airbnb, when we launched like Germany and Italy and Spain and all the other countries, is like you need separate teams that speak local languages, that translate copy and text and all this other stuff. So you're basically creating like multiple companies to operate in Europe. And that's why Europe is so hard for a tech founder. But in the US, it's so big and every city speaks the same language.
Do you feel like starting in Europe, though, in this area, in this world, kind of almost prepared you for the U.S. with an even greater strength for your career? Because it's like, if you can do it over there, where you're not familiar with a lot of things, right, you're learning as you go, when you come to the U.S. market, I'm not saying it's easy, but was it a much easier transition eventually?
Well, it was funny, because so based on the back of that company, the investors plopped me out and put me into another one, which is called Student.com. So okay. I started with those guys in Shanghai, China.
What?
We brought the team over to... Because like once you figure out a market, it's kind of the same market dynamics in any other. Like you need infrastructure and phone and engineers and really good teams, and it's the same concepts. It's just you learn to move at speed. So so I got known as that guy. So like I haven't interviewed for a job in 6 years basically. Because
you pretty much are like the fixer. You go in the sense of a team building. You know how to build like the core pieces to make it work.
That's right. Like if you can airdrop me into any country and you're like, go start a beer distributorship, like I could probably figure it out and build a team that would know more than I would. And we could do it really quickly in any country.
What made you feel like, what led to you being successful in this arena? Like, this is not an easy thing to just pick up and do. So what strengths or where do you think this came from that this just came, I don't want to say natural, but it sounds like it came very natural to you.
you know, and again, it's funny talking to you, like looking in reverse, like working on a farm or something like that, you realize one, work ethic means pretty much everything. And there's no blueprint for like building a fence or like doing all this other stuff. So you just figure it out. So if you have that ability, one, to work hard, two, just like figure it out and not get frustrated. And then having the experience launching in another country, you realize that the same market dynamics and interpersonal dynamics are the same. And then maybe like 20% is different that you need to localize your information on. And that's when you get, you know, if you have, when every time I was launching a new country, a new city, like I'd meet 20 new people that didn't know who I was. I'm like, hey, who's the coolest friend of yours in Las Vegas? Who's the coolest? And I would get the pulse really quickly. And that's kind of how you're taking in new markets and new countries. So it's basically taking like the farm boy attitude, like, hey, I can make anything happen. If I can wrestle a cow, like, yeah, I can start a tech office in London or something like that.
So, you know, you always hear these companies talk about like R&D and analytics and I'm researching.
Sure,
and I'm,
yeah.
Do you feel like it's more valuable and effective to be dropped into the actual situation and have human interaction and real life experience versus going off of just data or research?
I think it's a little bit of both. So, okay. For instance, when we were looking at launching Y-Plan, it was in New York, for instance, it was heavily data skewed. Like we had all of the data. Here's the total number of tickets sold. Here's the total number of venues. Here's the total number of players who own the venues. Here's the number of agents. And we scoped it out of like, here's what the numbers look like. And then we didn't take a trip. So it's like, here's the like what the business case is. It was like a multi-billion dollar company or multi-billion dollar opportunity. Madison Square Garden itself, if you won that over, was like a $300 million ticketing opportunity. Like we had all these like grand schematics and Excel spreadsheets everywhere. And then when I got there, I'm like, it's great. That's a good foundational starting point. But then what you need is you need to have the boots on the ground in the conversations. Because I went into a couple agent meetings with music agents. They're like, yeah, well, you can't get these rooms because Ticketmaster owns these guys. And if you can't strike a deal with Ticketmaster, you're not going to have access to any of these tickets. And like as an artist manager, I only have 10 tickets and you can't sell them. So even if I want to do that. So then after the first like 6 months, I was like, oh my God, this music side is going to be really, really difficult. And so like when you're launching new markets, it's like, it's a little bit of both. It's qualitative and quantitative. Quantitative justifies the means for going. And qualitative is the stuff you learn on the ground. Like, okay, is this actually a good opportunity or
yeah.
not?
So now you, the gentleman that you were with over at Y Plan, some of the investors see the potential in you, see that you're kind of like the nucleus to a lot of companies
yeah.
in it, as far as building out. You do student.com. Kind of what is that about? What's your role with this company now?
Yeah, so I mean, that was another thing for joining Airbnb too. I knew how big Airbnb was. So that was my calling card. So like on every investor pitch deck, it's like, oh, we have the guy that came from Airbnb. And it's like, it's, you know, if you, for people in music or PR, it's like you have William Morris for a year on your
yeah.
resume. Like something like that would be like, would help out. So same investors, saw that there's the specific skill set that I had. That was a real estate play for student housing. So very similar market dynamics to travel, actually. There's a specific number of kind of student apartments throughout the entire world. And then you need to acquire basically the supply, get those on under contract at a decent commission. And then you also have to acquire the students coming from overseas. The business was started in Shanghai. So it was all Chinese kids coming to the UK, Australia, and the US. So it was my job to start pairing like the outflow of student with actual properties. So I think I was employee 20. We raised $80 million for that business, which is insane. We went
wow.
from 20 employees to 350 employees in a year. And I went from Shanghai to London, helped out with London, and then brought the team over to the US and launched in New York. That team was about 40 people in the US at its height. So, and it was a big, big opportunity. We were doing about 40, 50 million in total gross transactions.
Wow.
But wasn't super profitable.
Got it. So you did this for how long?
Student.com was about 2 years.
Okay.
And in startups, that's kind of like...
It's a long time in startup world.
Yeah. That's I always say like a year in startup land is like three in anywhere else.
Yeah.
And because you're just compressing time. There is no like weekends or anything. You're working your ass off Monday through Sunday. And the problems that you encounter in one of those businesses, like most people don't see in their career. Like you're not getting sued that often. Like You're not like if you work for P&G, you're not launching a brand new company in a new country. It's like they already have your stuff.
Yeah.
You're going in there to sell more.
Yeah. There is no playbook for you.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And now, like, now that I've been doing kind of the land and expand and kind of expansion and GM roles, it's like there is a playbook. And you can systematize it, and there's like certain things you do at certain times and certain team members that you hire at certain times as well, and it's getting easier.
So. Nice. So now during this time, I kind of want to jump around a little bit.
Yes.
This is about 10 years now that you've been going in startup world, growing companies, living all over the world, traveling. Yeah, I kind of want to bring it back for a second now. So right before you graduated, you did your first Ironman. During this tenure of working in all these different industries and traveling, did you continue your regimen of challenging yourself on the athletic side?
Yeah. And so I was on the road. I mean, right when I joined Airbnb, I was on the road 300 days a year.
300.
And so I was consistently moving on. And with startups and especially with like school and all of this stuff is I always that like the work itself was, you know, 80% of my time. And the rest, I wanted to do like one hard thing a year. So what, like right after that, I got into ultras because I realized I didn't really like cycling that much. If you're training for an Ironman, you're cycling like 20 hours a week.
Okay.
And it was just way too much with my travel schedule. So the only thing I have when I'm traveling is my running shoes. So everywhere I was going, it was the first thing I would do, like right when I land, I would just start running. And then I heard about this race called the Ludva 100. I'm like, holy shit, like running 100 miles is absolutely bananas. Running a marathon was enough. Like to think that you're going to do that like three more times, it's just crazy. So I signed up for it.
Of course. I like how you just pitch it as like the craziest shit. And of course I signed up.
So yeah, signed up. And then I'm like, okay, what do I need to do? So I started doing like 50Ks, like 33 miles. 50 milers, and that was just one of the things that was always kind of sprinkled in my calendar. I always had a few races that I was doing throughout the year, so there's a reason for me to kind of stay in shape. And I did my first 50 miler in San Francisco in like 2012, I think, and it took me like 14 hours. I was like, oh my God, this is the craziest thing ever. I was sore for weeks, and like most things that I've done at that time, if you asked me if I'd ever do it again, I would say absolutely no. And then a week later, I'm like signing up for something else.
Yeah.
And that was just kind of a theme that was going on. I was like working my ass off at work and startups and stuff. And then I was doing the running, the hard stuff, because I was exercising my mind at work and then exercising my body. And that's kind of how like I tied the two together. So, yeah. And that's – so I've always – yeah, sign up for one hard thing that scares you every single year was kind of my motto.
So it wasn't necessarily that you wanted to be like known as an endurance athlete. You just wanted to constantly challenge yourself.
Yeah. It was just something that I did on the side because I grew up. It was like you're not only do you work, but you also do your extracurriculars. And that's always what I thought I needed to do to fill my time. And that's what I kind of learned after I quit baseball. I was like, okay, what am I to do with these extra few hours? And so it wasn't that I wanted to be a professional athlete. I know I'm not gifted enough to do that. But it was just something I did. And it was always like a really nice kind of like calling card when people are like, oh, so what else do you do outside of like working? I'm like, oh, well, you know, sometimes I'll run for 24 hours at a time.
You know, little stuff like that.
You know, little stuff like that.
Somebody's like talking to you, like, I hit the gym this morning for 45 minutes, killed it. You're like, I ran 45 miles.
Right. And so like one of the stupid interview questions that you always get was like, so we work really hard here. Like, can you give me an example of like working hard and like busting through barriers and all this stuff? I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I do that at work too. But then like I also run these things and it's a nice attribute. And I always thought it was just a good quality to have. And I felt like when you work on your body, it naturally transfers over to like your, you know, yourself, your family. And like the harder things you do is I always call it like sharpening your saw. And that's what I was doing with the running thing. It was like, it was just mentally making me stronger.
Yeah.
So that work was that much easier.
Do you feel like fitness, health, and all of that is instrumental in people's success?
In general, I think if you look at the most successful people in the world, I'm sure there's a theme there. Like they're most of the times they're meditators. They eat fairly well, and there is some sort of exercise regimen that's in there because they know if their body feels good, their mind feels good, and they can work the hours that they can to make the money that they have. So I think I wouldn't necessarily say it's a recipe, but I would say that on the whole, Absolutely. Like, you need to have some sort of regimen in there that it, you just feel better. You feel, everything feels better. Your head's more clear. Your family's happier. Your friends are happier. And you're getting stronger mentally and physically. It just,
yeah,
I think there's a lot that cross over in between every aspect of your life.
So now you're doing, working like crazy, 300 days out of the year traveling. You are still doing challenges throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
Then you decide one day to do the biggest challenge to date, which I'll kind of let you expand upon. And I don't even know how you even came to this conclusion that this was a good idea. It sounds epic. And I'm like, I want to do this. And then you gave me the background story. And I was like, I don't think I can. And I'm crazy. I don't think I can do what you did. So can you talk a little bit about the rowing challenge that you got involved with?
Yeah, sure. So the little rowing challenge is called the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. And it's billed as the hardest rowing race on planet Earth. And it's a three.
Planet Earth. I love that. Not just in the country, not in the state. Planet Earth.
Yeah. And it's so it's a 3,000-mile rowing challenge from off the coast of Africa in the Canary Islands to Antigua in the Virgin Islands. The average time you spend out there is anywhere from 40 to 110 days. And it's all self-contained. There's one safety vessel. So there's usually about 25 teams that do this every couple of years. And there's one safety vessel that sits at the back of the fleet. And they don't stay with you. So like when you're in the middle of the Atlantic, they could be 1,000 miles away. So there is no element of safety. So you are in the boat on your own. You have to carry your own provisions. You have your own water maker. You're doing your own navigation. You're dealing with storms and sharks and all the other stuff on your own. And like most things, I did this ultra marathon called Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc in Chamonix, France. And it's one of the harder 100 milers in the world. And it's basically a trail run on the French, Swiss, and Italian Alps. And we were in a pub afterwards, and this guy came up to us. He's like, oh, you think you guys are really tough for doing this race? And we just thought we were going to get in a fight. We're like, okay, what does this French guy want? And it turns out he's like, well, if you guys think you can do this, my brother-in-law just rowed a rowboat across the Atlantic Ocean. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? It like just went in one ear and out the other. And the guy that I was running with, he was like, oh my God, that's cool. And it kind of, there was like the gestation period of a couple of years. And then finally I get a call on Christmas Eve of like, I think it was 2014. He's like, I just signed us up to row across the Atlantic Ocean in 2 years. We have 2 years to train.
It's a nice little window.
Right? And I was like, my reaction was like, cool. Yeah, sounds great. And yeah, so we looked at this like a startup. You know, most, like when I go into new markets and stuff, it's always about meeting the people who have done it, who have been there, who have launched, have done all the other stuff. So we looked at this like a business case. We're like, okay, I want to talk to all the people that have rowed across the Atlantic. I want to see who the people who have won. I want to figure out who their boat maker was. And I want to conduct all these interviews and figure out what's going on. So we did all that. We spent 2 years in training. We spent about 300 hours in the North Sea. And again, I was spending time between New York and London at the time. So we found the best boat builder in the world who happened to be based in England. And so we were rowing our boat between like the Netherlands and England for a couple of years. We found an amazing team of doctors that were working with Team Great Britain for like their soccer or football and their rowing team. So like we had this badass team around us that was like, we wanted to set the world record. And yeah, well, like when I explained the race, it was when you leave La Gomera in the Canary Islands in this 18-foot rowboat, it's 18 feet by 4 feet wide. It's made of carbon fiber and Kevlar.
It's not a lot of width.
It's not a big boat. And especially for like me and one other guy, it's like you're always within reach. You're never like, there's nowhere to go. And when you leave the island after 4 hours, you can't see anything. You see wide open ocean for as far as you can see. And that's the only thing that you're going to see.
What is your first thought when you see this and there's like nothing around you? Did shit get real then? Were you like, okay, like now this is serious?
Yeah. So like right, because we left, I think like midday. And so at like 7 p.m. it was dark. And when it was dark, you can barely see the lights of the island. And then it set in. And we took off in a storm as well. And like the first start of a storm. So, and when you get out there, the waves are much bigger than when you were kind of like training and stuff. So we were seeing any waves, not at that time, but like during the entire time, we're seeing waves that are anywhere from 10 to 40 feet high. Excuse me, huge rollers. And right when we left La Gomera, And like the first night, we were both seasick, and so we're throwing up everywhere. Our power was already starting to malfunction. So we were like, oh my God, like, is this like life? And you're just not, you're running on adrenaline at that point. Yeah. You're not tired yet, but you're like starting to get sick, and it's just starting to set in that you're going to be out here for a really, really long time. And I think we got really sick, and then your body's not used to eating. So you're not hungry because your stomach you feel like you're on a roller coaster for days and days and days. So after 3 or 4 days, you're finally starting to eat again. You're starting to get into your rhythm, and then it becomes like clockwork. Your body's used to sleeping 45 minutes at a time. And typically how, when you're rowing, it's 2 hours on, 2 hours off. So one guy rows for 2 hours, the other guy rests for 2 hours, and then you switch. And that sounds nice, but like after you finish your rowing shift, you got things to do. You have to make water. You have to clean yourself off because you're covered in salt, and you don't want to bring that in the cabin because it gets on everything. You have to cook your food. You have to clean things. So like by the time you get back to the cabin, you maybe send a couple of emails out because we had satellite phone. You've got 45 minutes before you have to wake up and put your stuff back on and then get back out there. So your body is a miracle, and it just naturally gets into that sleep state where I was like, after 2 minutes, I can get into like deep, deep sleep and have like dreams and stuff. So your body is after the first week, it was normalized.
How much food did you pack for this? Because I believe it was a pretty large amount, because your calorie intake needs to be quite significant, right?
Yeah, so you're burning between 7,000 and 8,000 calories a day, because you're rowing anywhere from 12 to 16 hours a day. And we rowed all the way up to 18 hours at one point. And so your caloric requirements are through the roof. But physically, you just can't eat that much. Like, you just really can't. We took a million calories, literally a million calories. We were eating 6 to 7 meals a day, basically every session that you were off. But you had to like warm up your water and put it into freeze-dried food because it needed to be light enough that it didn't weigh down the boat. So you had to do this all the time. And it was funny because the first few weeks I was heating up my water to make like warm spaghetti or warm Thai food and all that stuff. About halfway through, I was like, fuck it, I'm not heating up my water anymore. I'm just gonna eat cold food, because like you just didn't even mentally look forward to it. It was like, you're just throwing food down your throat. You're not even like enjoying it. But yeah, so we were trying to eat. I think we were probably eating for about 4,000 to 5,000 calories if we could, but it was so hard. Like, you're just eating for sport. It's not enjoyable. And you never felt like eating. So I think I lost like 25, 30 pounds when I finished, because you're just burning through everything. I was like a gaunt ghost when I finished.
So now you're on this journey. You're a couple days in. The previous record, so I just want to also kind of clarify this for people that are listening. There's different categories. So there's a 2-pair team, a 4-pair team, and is there a
and
single
solos,
and
yeah.
solos as well, right?
Yeah.
So in the pair team, yeah. the fastest time, there has been Americans to compete before, yeah. right? The fastest time period was how many days?
I think it was like 53 or 54 days.
Okay, and your goal is to not only just beat that, but to win it all together.
We wanted to win it, and we wanted to break the world record. So the pair's world record was 39 days.
Okay.
There's less than 200 pair teams that have ever crossed the Atlantic. There's 10 American teams that have done it. We wanted to be the fastest American and then also break the world record.
Got it. So you're at a pretty good speed if you're trying to break this. And yeah. you're going through 10 to 40, you know, foot height waves coming in at you, yeah. pitch dark storms. What are some, you know, I'm sure there was a million crazy things that went down.
Yep.
What are kind of like the 2 or 3 moments that you were like, holy shit, like, this is insane?
So I think there's a few things that happened at different stages of the race. And I think the first crazy one is we hit our first storm. I think this is like mile like 700 or something like that.
Mile 700.
And this is what's crazy about it is that the hardest part was getting to mile 1500. Because up until then, every 2-hour shift, you're rowing like 3 to 4 miles. So you would get off your shift and you're like, okay, I just rowed 4 miles. Now we've got like 1980 miles to go. And it just didn't like, it didn't seem real. It just seemed like you were kind of playing until you saw the miles tick down on the after you hit halfway. So I think, miles 750, we hit our first storm. And we, at that time too, our power started to fail. So your power is super important. One, because you need like the lights and navigation. The other part is it's for your water maker that desalinates the seawater and turns into drinking water. So if that doesn't replenish itself, you're drinking like your safety water, which you're not supposed to touch unless like a shark eats you or like something crazy happens. And most of the other boats that were actually working well is that there's an auto helm. It means that you put in the navigation and the boat will steer itself, and then you just provide the power. So if you have no power, you have no steering, no water, and there's no way for other boats to see you because your navigation isn't on. So we called it ghost protocol because like no one could see us. They didn't even know we existed. Basically, you could see the GPS beacon on the map, but you couldn't like radio to us because our power was out. So then we go through storms, and these storms are, it's not like the movie A Perfect Storm, but it was, the waves were like that, but they're not like crashing. They're just giant rollers, and the wind is going in the opposite direction. So the waves were going in the opposite direction, the wind's going in the opposite direction, like by like 40, 50 miles. So basically what you do is you throw out this giant parachute that sits underneath the water, and it try to hold your position against the current because it's pushing you backwards. So we're mile 750. We really haven't settled into like life on the boat. Things are like crappy. You're hungry. You're tired. Now you're like first starting to miss home. And we go through the storm. It's 2 days, and you cannot row into it because you're just getting blown back even further. So you put in this power anchor, your boat is rocking like you're in a washing machine, and all you can do is sit there in your boat. So you're in this tiny little boat, you're shoulder to shoulder, leg to leg, half naked, sweating because it's also tropical weather. And we did that for 48 hours. So for 48 hours, you're laying horizontal, sweating with another dude side by side, getting turned around like you're in a washing machine. Ugh. And so you didn't know when it was going to end, and it was just, the whole thing was miserable. So that was like the first storm where I was like, this is, I signed up for this. Like I paid a lot of money to be here, and this is the worst thing ever. And if there was an eject button, oh, I would have pushed the shit out of it.
So there was points you were ready to quit.
Well, yeah, then it was like miserable. I'm like, I know the storm is going to be here for 2 days.
And you're like, I got like 40 more days of this.
40 more days. And then we flip on our navigation, and I get an email from my now wife. And she's like, yeah, you guys drifted like 78 miles backwards.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah. So finally, yeah, we come out of the storm and we're like way behind everyone. And we were just positioned in a way where we were north enough of some of the other teams where we got it really bad. So like we were in the running of like the best teams there. And then we got pushed back that much further. Everyone else got pushed back like 30, 40 miles. So we're like, we just lost an entire day. And so to like get out the oars again and fix stuff and be like, well, let's go. We've got another 2,250 miles to go. And yeah, so it's like, and then, yeah, it's just a mental trip. And you just kind of convince yourself, oh, I've got 2 hours. That's all I got to do. I got to come out here and I got to work for 2 hours at a time. And that's it.
Would you say it was more mentally challenging or physically challenging?
This race is a mental race. It is, physically it was demanding. I mean, imagine sitting on a rowing machine for 16 hours a day. Like that's what it was like, but it was more mental because you see nothing. You see the same horizon, there's no boats or anything around you. So you see nothing and then you don't talk to anyone.
Yeah. And that's gotta be
that. And that's the worst part. Like, I think like feeling alone is, that's probably the worst thing.
Castaway movie.
It was exactly like, we actually had a Wilson on the boat as well. So he sat up front. And like now it was kind of who you talk to. Because like when you switch positions with your rowing partner, you've got 5 minutes to tell them about the weather and what's going on and give them a little chit-chat.
And then they go down probably half the time.
Yeah. And then you go in the cabin and they do their 2 hours. So you've got, if you add it all up, you've got 30 minutes of interaction a day. And then you have a complete sensory deprivation of seeing nothing.
Did you ever capsize in any of this?
Yeah. So during that storm, we capsized once. And right, actually, the day before that storm, it was just starting to hit. And I was in the cabin, and I woke up on the roof, on the ceiling. And all of our gear was out of the side pockets. And the boat automatically self-rights. So it starts turning over. And it took about 10 seconds. Once we turn over, I open up the cabin door because it's airtight. And I see my rowing partner crawling up the side. He's like, oh my God, we got hit with a rogue wave. And then it happened. We capsized another again in another storm, probably a few weeks later. Same thing happened. Woke up on the ceiling and he was outside. That's in the water.
You know, it's insane when you just said a few weeks later.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
It just happened again. So it's like most people like, you know, yeah, years later, but you're literally still going. Like, that just put in perspective of how long this shit's going for.
Yeah. I mean, we were out there for 45 days and 45 days doesn't even do it justice. It's 6 weeks, 6 whole weeks. And most people go on they don't even take that much vacation a year.
I mean, let's put in perspective. That's a month and a half.
Yeah.
A month and a half in a rowboat.
In a rowboat, eating the same food
with
looking
one
at the
person
same thing
and Wilson.
With one person and Wilson.
So now let's kind of jump to the time period. So the record for the fastest American pair ever was 50-something days.
53 or 54 days, yeah.
Okay. And you all ended up completing it in what?
In 45 days.
So you hold the record.
We're the fastest Americans to row across the Atlantic.
When you heard that, what was the feeling?
I mean, because we had a week to think about it. We were doing the math. And
that's
we were,
so true. You're like, yeah.
We had a couple of weeks to think about it. So we knew that if we hit these mile markers and we were going 50 to 60 miles a day, that the math would work out. So we knew we were going to beat it. We didn't know by how much. And then we wanted to finish it during the day. So we wanted to... most everyone, for some reason, they finish at night, and not on their fault, but just the way the timing works.
How it all works out.
So we're like, okay, this is row as hard as we can and get in during the day, because it's amazing to have a reception when everyone's like actually out. And so the last day we rode 24 hours straight, and that's like when hallucinations were starting, and it was just.
Did you start to hallucinate?
Yeah.
Really.
It only happened once, and it was funny because I was rowing. He was he took a 15-minute rest, so the cabin door was open, and I was rowing. And I was like, Phil, I've got a tarantula. There's a giant tarantula on my hand.
That is not good. I hate spiders. Yeah. I would have tripped out.
So I was like, I was freaking out. And so I woke him up. I'm like, Phil, there's a tarantula on my hand. And he was so fucked up too. He was like, how did a tarantula get in the boat? Like, there's like no way a sea creature can like obviously crawl over your rowboat. So finally I was like, wow, it's just hallucinating.
That's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah.
So you finish, you break the record. You didn't win, but if you didn't get sent back, do you feel like you guys would have pulled it off?
We would have been in the running. Okay. If we didn't have the two storms, and as a team, like we actually didn't work that well together. And when we had our interviews with Nat Geo and all the other race promo stuff and our brands afterwards, I was like, independently, we worked well together.
Got it.
And what that means is like we both did as well as we could individually, but together we didn't pull, you know, at the same pace, and didn't pick each other up nearly as much as we probably should have. But without the storms, and it would have been a very close record probably.
But I mean, nonetheless, the fastest American pair to ever do it is pretty unbelievable. Are you still like blown away by it?
I've moved on. Moved, like, I've started thinking about other things.
So you're already on to the next challenge.
Yeah, I'm already on to something else, and I've got a new family now. It's just different. But in the time, I was like, it was really important to me. Now it's records are meant to be broken, and hopefully, you know, with all the other media stuff that I've done, hopefully I've inspired someone else to go row. And you know, I remember reading about some random ass guy when I was in high school in one of those magazines that rode, was sponsored by Richard Branson, and rode across the Atlantic. And I was like, that is the craziest thing ever. So I'm in the middle of nowhere in Washington State with like no prospects of life. And I read this article about this other guy that rode across the Atlantic, and it seems so foreign, but I'm like, that probably planted the seed for me to say yes to this before I even like ever sat on a rowing machine. And so hopefully like whoever's like listening or all the stories that I tell, I'm like, hopefully one guy's like, yeah, fuck it. And yeah, we're going to go do this. Yeah. Why not?
So when you finished it, what was the first thing you did? Was it shower? Was it food? Like, what did you want to do?
So, for weeks and weeks and weeks, you're thinking about the first things you're going to eat. Like that just,
that's all you think about.
You think about the things you're going to eat, think about the things you're going to do. You're planning your life. You're like, you're thinking about everything you want to change in your life, because when you're rowing, like life is broken down to very, very small decisions. Like it is the most simple form of living. Like it's like extreme camping. Basically, you have a tiny little shelter, you've got your food, and you have some sort of physical activity. Everything else is extraneous. So you look at all these aspects of your life. You're like, well, I don't need that. I don't need this person. I want to change this. Like, this is what I want to do differently. So you had all this time to think about that. So when we landed, like, I usually am like a stubbled guy. Like, I shave once a week. And I had this giant ginger beard. I didn't even know my beard was red until I grew it out. And I was like, I just want to get rid of this, like, Eric the Red beard. Like, I look like what's his name from Game of Thrones. And so I was like, first thing I'm doing, I'm going to fucking shave this beard off. And then I'm going to eat everything. Like, there wasn't one thing I wanted. I wanted all of it. And the funny thing that they do is they have this big press tent. And then they give you a burger and a beer, like, right when you land. Like, you hug your family. And then they put you into this tent and then take a bunch of pictures of you eating this burger. And it was the best burger I've ever had in my life. Because It was like, we haven't had, like, a real fresh anything. So, yeah, I wanted a burger, and then I wanted, like, Fresca or, like, some, like, LaCroix sparkling cold water. Because, again, you haven't had anything cold for 45 days.
Wow.
And then when I got back to the hotel, I showered, and that was the most religious experience I've ever had in my life. Because I took one bucket shower with, like, soap and stuff. So, showered, and then I shaved.
You must have felt amazing.
It was, yeah, like... there's nothing else to describe it other than like a religious experience. It was like, I was in there probably for an hour.
Wow.
Just relishing in hot water. It was amazing. And and then the following 3 days we were at this all-inclusive resort, this nice one in Antigua, and we'd go to dinner and I would have all of their starters, like three or four mains, and then all of their desserts. And they're like, ha ha ha, yeah, you're a little guy, think you're hungry. And I was like, I swear, guys, I'm like, just bring it all out.
I'm going to destroy this.
I'm going to destroy this. And then I'd like totally, I mean, thousands and thousands of calories of food per setting. And then I'd be hungry 2 hours later.
That's crazy. Yeah. So now, up until this point in life, you've been successful in business. You've pushed the envelope and broken records in endurance athlete sports. What's next for you? We'll kind of go in two different lanes here since you're kind of multiversatile in this regard. From the competitive side, what is the next race or challenge that you're looking to do?
So I'm going to do Leadville again this year.
Okay.
Leadville 100 again this year. And then, I want to do a couple hundreds, you know, over the course of this year. I had this grand goal of circumnavigating the globe on human power. So you rode the oceans and then you cycle the continents. This is more of like a 10-year project.
Okay. This is pretty epic though.
Yeah. So there's only been, I think there's one guy who's ever done it, two guys that have ever done it, and they did it over the course of 10 years or something like that. So that's like the big goal that I want to do.
Okay.
And then I'm getting in a lot into like alpinism and climbing mountains and stuff now. So I've got a lot of good friends that have climbed the Seven Summits, and I think that's kind of the direction I'm going. So ultras are great base builders, and you meet a lot of really cool people, and I'm convincing a lot of people now to start 200s.
Yeah.
And
start 200s.
Start doing hundreds.
Sorry. Oh, I was about to say, holy shit.
That, like, is a thing now.
Is there 200s?
Yeah, there's this one that was just in Utah like 2 weeks ago. It was 220 miles. It takes like 5 days or something like that.
Wow. Yeah. So really, once you kind of conquer a certain space, you're on to the next one.
Yeah, man. Like the thing about, well, like when you do, it's the same thing in business. It's the same thing in life. It's like once you finish something, a new horizon reveals itself. And you know, you can't rest on your laurels on like your past accomplishments. I don't always want to be the guy that rode. Like, there's other things I want to do.
Yeah.
And now that you're in, you just get into a different crowd and a different group. And like, as you guys continue to like grow and rise, it's like you see some interesting stuff that you want to do. And I think I want to keep having fun and do some hard stuff every single year. And then eventually do, you know, once that wraps up, you know, circumnavigating the globe on human power would be kind of cool.
Wow. Now, on the business front, what are you working on? What do you have coming up, you know, kind of in that regard?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a sucker for punishment. I joined another startup, and the company's called Nucleus, and it was in the smart home space. And yeah, and so, you know, it was a business that was doing like $10 million a year. They wanted me to come in and grow it to like $50 million a year. And then we've had a bunch of different issues. One of our largest investors actually copied our product. You can also, you know, and it kind of thrown us off. It killed our business overnight, literally. So we had to lay off some of the team, and we've pivoted the entire company into kind of the telehealth and remote monitoring space for seniors. So I'm in the middle of building that business out. And it's been an interesting challenge. But now it's like going through something like that, people would be really, really bummed out about losing almost 100% of your business and starting over and doing all the endurance stuff, it's like, you know, what are you going to do? You got to put one foot in front of the other and figure it out. And yeah, so I'm doing that now, and I advise a lot of other companies. I'm an advisor and mentor here at Engage Ventures. And yeah, I help out probably about 10 different startups between here and New York. And so I'm in the space, and I like meeting really cool founders that are doing cool stuff. And we invest in a bunch of different food companies, and yeah, it's just fun.
You know, what's pretty interesting is most people run away from challenges or issues or hurdles, and it's almost like challenges, hiccups, problems, or things that can't be done or shouldn't be done are kind of your fuel. Like, you feed off
right.
of it.
Yeah. Like, do you watch Game of Thrones?
I don't. I saw, like,
man, you just lost half your fan
I know,
base.
I want to make a very clear statement here. My wife is obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Everybody I know is obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I watched about 6 episodes.
Okay, that's fair.
No, it's good. It's good. Okay. The problem is with me, I'm a binge watcher. So
and
if
this
I
would
watch,
take you like a month.
This would take me so long.
Yeah,
in my ADD, I'm like, look,
yeah.
I need to watch, like, you know, something that
stuff.
I could watch one season and
right.
knock it out in like 8 or 10, like Ray Donovan.
See, I haven't gotten into that one yet, but yeah,
amazing,
this is a whole
shows.
Other conversation.
When it gets into the fantasy world stuff, I've never been a big,
that's fair.
Big fan.
I get it.
Doesn't mean you can't listen to Culturation, but just never been a big fan.
That's right.
I'll give it a shot, though.
there's this point in there where one of the characters says chaos is a ladder. And so when you're talking about, like, challenges and all this other stuff, a lot of people would be like, oh my God, I'm not good enough. I'm not ready. I can't have that conversation. I can't run that far. I can't do that stuff. And I think when... Like when you have something that, like, looks like a challenge or smells like a challenge, that is, like, the biggest, not motivator, but, like, that means the wind's blowing in your direction. Because a lot of people, when they get to that, they're going to stop. So I think in challenges in business and all the other stuff, that kills most other people. And if you just develop the muscle to keep going when shit gets tough and it becomes convoluted and all this stuff, you just get better at it. And then a challenge... Like, what would look like a challenge to me would look like a giant mountain to someone else. And now, like, all these, like, crazy things that are happening, I'm just like, yeah, that's tough. But
yeah.
We have to figure it out. And I think that's the thing about, like, experience. Is like, you can't read a book and understand that until you go through all this crazy stuff. And you just see that, like, oh, yeah, that's just what you have to do.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so, like, that you get better at it. You get better at dealing with shit as you get older.
So you've touched on a lot of stuff today. I think a lot of people are going to literally be super inspired on both the business front and also just the training front. If somebody's listening and you want them to take away one piece of advice or one thing to kind of keep in mind to leave with, what would that be?
Sure. No, if there's one piece, like, you know, I've done a lot of really cool endurance events and done some, like, cool business stuff, but none of that I've been ready for. Like, I've never been prepared to do something. So, like, the one little nugget I'd leave people with is like, do something before you're ready. Don't question it. Just sign up and do it. You're never going to be as ready as you think. You're never going to have all the answers. And just know that once you start marching in that direction, it gets easier and easier.
Very cool.
And, and when something scares you, that means you should do it.
I love that. I'm all about that. So for anybody that wants to follow you, kind of keep up with your journey, see the next crazy thing you're going to do, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So on the socials, on Instagram, I'm at Daily Irvin, and Twitter, I'm at Daily Irvin as well. And I'm more active on Instagram than I am on anything else.
Okay.
Snapchat. I just, yeah, lost it. So
yeah. I
Instagram,
never even made my first
well.
Snap. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was yeah. So Twitter and Instagram for sure.
All right, perfect. Man, appreciate you coming on today.
Chatting,
I think,
man.
You know, honestly, amazing. I'm about to go now sign up for my next crazy challenge because of what you've done. You've inspired me. So my next is, honestly, I think I'm going to do an ultra. I think I'm going to go for 100 mile because of you.
We're going to do it.
Let's go.
I think this is why, like, wives hate me. It's because they're like, who is this guy that you bring in your friend circle, and why are you, like, you're going to go
listen,
run for
listen, my home? Wife is going to expect it, so it's thankfully
God,
she's
good.
Learned at this
oh
point.
God.
But
she's
she may
too,
she may
so.
Want to talk to you first just to kind of get some background context and make sure I'm not going to die.
Yeah, and then if you need help, she can speak to my wife. Be like, hey, my wife, calm it down. So,
perfect.
Yeah, we'll play it.
All right, man. Appreciate you coming in today.
Thanks
Daily.
Appreciate it.
Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.